either not distinctly military in nature. The third and final thing, and this goes back to the idea of a mass assassination factory, is that there is a systematic policy, according to sources, of targeting private residential homes of Hamas or jihadi operatives when they are in these private homes, when they are in these buildings or private residences. And just so you understand, I mean, what this means is that the military is knowingly dropping a bomb that weighs a ton or often more on a residential building in order to assassinate one person, knowingly killing that person's family and neighbors in the process, when according to sources, in the vast majority of cases, these buildings are not places where there is military activity that is being conducted. It is an assassination against somebody who is in Hamas or Jihad's military brigades, but they are not in a military place. One source who was particularly critical of this policy said that he thought it was like if Israel would bomb, if a Palestinian militant group would bomb the homes of Israelis, not when they are wearing their army uniform, but when they are going back home in the weekend, and essentially assassinating them through the bodies of their families or their neighbors, and then saying that they use those families as human shields. Now, I think that we've talked about these power targets and we've talked about these assassination targets, and of course, there are many different types of targets that could be considered under international law more legitimate. For example, militant cells, for example, ammo warehouses, for example, rocket launcher pits. And I think that to look at the civilian devastation that is happening right now in Gaza, you have to understand that it's a consequence of a particular Israeli war policy. It is a war policy that has a very loose interpretation of what a military target is, also attacking people in civilian spaces. It is a war policy that centers on deterrence and hitting these power targets that are intended to place civilian pressure on Hamas. And it is a war policy that is increasingly being helped by the use of big data, automation software, and AI. And again, I don't know everything. I've only spoken to several sources, but my evidence suggests that many of the civilians who are being killed in Gaza are being killed as a result of these policies that I do not think are justifiable policies. International law experts would call them war crimes. And that's why I don't think that what Blinken is saying is true, honestly.
We're going to talk more about war crimes later in the program. Yuval Abraham, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli Jewish journalist based in Jerusalem who writes for 972 magazine and Local Call. We'll link to your new piece, A Mass Assassination Factory, Inside Israel's Calculated Bombing of Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Vermont, where family members of three Palestinian college students shot in Burlington Saturday night are arriving to care for their sons, who they say were targeted simply for being Palestinian. In a minute, we'll speak with the mother of Hishem Aratani. He was shot in the spine when he took a walk with his friends, Kenan Abdelhamid and Tahsin Ali Ahmed, after they visited relatives while staying in Hisham Graham's mother's house for Thanksgiving break. All three have been friends since the first grade at the Ramallah Friends School in the West Bank. Two of them were wearing keffiyehs, the symbol of Palestinian pride, when they were shot. Their alleged attacker, Jason Eaton, has pleaded not guilty to three counts of attempted murder. Authorities have not yet added a hate crime enhancement to his charges. The Associated Press reports Eaton had a history of domestic disputes that led police to confiscate his shotgun a decade ago. NBC News reported Tuesday that another ex-girlfriend told police in 2019 Eaton had continued calling and texting her and driving by her house after she'd made it clear she didn't want to communicate with him and she'd considered filing a restraining order. So often, mass shooters have abused women in their past. At a vigil Monday on the campus of Brown University, where Hisham Aratani is a student, Professor Bashar Dumani, the Mahmoud Darwish Professor of Palestinian Studies, read a statement from Hisham.
I would like to start out by saying that I greatly appreciate all the love and prayers being sent my way. Who knew that all I had to do to become famous was to get shot? And as much as I appreciate and love every single one of you here today, I am but one casualty in this much wider conflict. Had I been shot in the West Bank, where I grew up, the medical services which saved my life here would likely have been withheld by the Israeli army. The soldier who would have shot me would go home and never be convicted. I understand that the pain is so much more real and immediate because many of you know me. But any attack like this is horrific, be it here or in Palestine. This is why when you send your wishes and light your candles for me today, your mind should not just be focused on me as an individual, but rather as a proud member of a people being oppressed.
That statement from Hisham Awatani was read at a vigil Monday night at Brown University's campus, where he's a student. Hisham's mother, Elizabeth Price, joins us now from Burlington after traveling from her home in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank to be with her son in the hospital. Welcome to Democracy Now, Elizabeth. I'm so sorry you're here under these circumstances. Can you talk about how Hisham is doing and his friends, the two other Palestinian students shot on Saturday night?
Hisham makes me so proud. I mean, he was lying in his bed, paralyzed from the chest down, in great pain from broken bones and in shock, and traumatized. And he typed out that statement to be read out to a vigil. And I was so impressed with his ability to focus on others during that, in this time of his life being devastated. He is in stable condition. He is going to be transferred to a rehabilitation center so that he can learn to live with his injuries, and then also hopefully and definitely return on a path towards full mobility, we hope. His other friends are also stable. One has been discharged from the hospital, but is severely traumatized. You know, he spent 45 minutes thinking that his friends had been shot dead. And then the third young man, because they are children to me since they grew up in my house, is stable and working towards discharged. But they are all traumatized, and they are all feeling grateful to be alive and feeling the bitterness of the fact that they are receiving such attention and such support and such incredible medical services from the Burlington community and the Burlington Medical Facility, while at the same time people are dying under the bombs of the Israeli bombardment. I mean, the fact that the Israelis have started bombarding again the Gaza Strip is something that will crush them more than their injuries have crushed them. My son said that when he went through the list of those who had died under the Israeli bombardment a few weeks ago, he found that there were 30 that had his name, Hisham. And he has said in another statement to a Brown newspaper, he says, to remember, like he said in the vigil, I am the Hisham you know. And I think that he just really wants people to be thinking about the Palestinians who are dying by the tens of thousands right now, and not to be focusing on him. And I think this is something that he this is a sentiment that is shared by his friends as well.
I'm wondering if you can tell us, although he wants to talk about himself as he said, a member of an oppressed community, think of all the people who don't get help when they're shot right now in Gaza and the West Bank. But if you could tell us about Hisham, he's Palestinian, Irish, American. Is that right?
Yes.
20 years old, a junior at Brown?
Yes, yes. So Hisham was born in America and is a devoted Giants fan. He grew up in Palestine. He's an Irish citizen because I was born in Ireland, and he's Palestinian because his father is Palestinian, and grew up in Palestine. He's a born mathematician. He has mathematics in his family. he once said to me that just numbers make him happy. And he is the type of person who he's a polymath. He's a polyglot. You know, he speaks
what
Arabic
languages
and English.
Does he speak?
Arabic and English fluently. He has, he's studying, he's very good at Persian right now. He's been taking Persian. He took, Cuneiform College. So he, you know, can write in an extinct language. He has studied Hebrew and German and French in high school. And he is currently studying Spanish and Italian at Brown. And he, is doing a BSc in pure mathematics at college. He went in as a math student. And then when he took a course in archaeology, he was just hit by a bug for archaeology, bitten by the bug of archaeology. Now he's doing a BSc in math and a BA in archaeology. Not really quite sure how those two things go together, but Hisham has the ability to just suck in information, create this incredible database of knowledge that he can make quite rapidly connections with, and then come out with a conclusion that he shares with people. I mean, he's a computer in his brain. And yet at the same time, he's very soulful and very philosophical. And I think in the last few days, I mean, this hasn't even been a week since this happened to him. In the last few days, I've really understood how Hisham has the ability to have his soul and his heart encompass his people, and for him to be able to contextualize the suffering that he's had within what is something that he sees as the valid and the dignity of his people. So I think that is giving him great comfort. There's an Arabic word, sumud, which means resilience. It's about the concept of existence being resistant, staying on your land no matter what. And Hisham, for me, signifies and symbolizes that concept. He is like an olive tree that he can get cut down, but he will regrow. And that is where he gets the strength to be thinking about other people and about his people, even while he lies in a bed unable to move.
Well, I think we can also see where he gets his spirit from you, Elizabeth.
I'm lucky to be his mother. I am blessed to be his mother. I'm so privileged to have gotten to know him in my life.
So can you talk about them growing up in the Ramallah Friends School? We spoke with the head of the school, who is now head of the whole American Friends Service Committee in the United States, Joyce Ajlouni. Talk about his experience growing up in Ramallah, where you live, and going to this Quaker school.
Well, I mean, life in Ramallah and life in Palestine is a beautiful thing. Obviously, we live under military occupation, and so, you know, people are killed every day, and often they are children. Children are arrested, and people are arrested, and often the school goes on strike because in solidarity with the news of someone being killed by the Israeli army. So it's a life that where, you know, when the school goes on strike, that someone's lost their life, and the walls of the streets around, the school are filled with pictures of people who have been killed, in memory of them. But Ramallah and Palestine is a place of family and community. It's a place where everyone knows each other and you feel safe. My daughter, who's 17, can walk home late at night in safety because everyone respects the other and sees the other as a member of a larger society or community or family. And so you're never alone, and you're always, everyone acts to take care of each other. So these boys grew up together. They did Model United Nations. They talked, and they did math club, and they did chess club, and they would come to my house on a Saturday afternoon, like giraffes, you know, as they grew up over the years, and they would duck under my threshold and sprawl over on my couches, and I would make them food, and then they would cram themselves into Hisham's tiny room, and they would just talk about philosophy and politics and language, and then just talk about, you know, just joke with each other. And then when they were receiving their college results, for those who had applied to American colleges, you get the results at like 3 a.m. in Palestine. So they would stay up together and they would be on the phone to each other, and they would be there for each other. So one person up opened their email, and if it was good news, they would celebrate. If it was bad news, they would commiserate. And so that helped them survive so much. And the three boys who you mentioned, Hisham and his two friends, are like brothers. And I think that that has been so important for them. After they were shot, they were kept in the same ICU room. for a number of days by the hospital, because the hospital recognized that the proximity meant that they could be with each other and give each other strength. Kenan, who has been released, was the least hurt, but was deeply, deeply traumatized by the experience that he went through when he thought that his friends had been killed. And so by keeping him, even though he could be released with the boys, the hospital was able to give them that comfort of being with each other and having that camaraderie and that brotherhood sustain them in the time where they were just trying to come to grips with the hatred that had been shown to them, the devastation of their lives, and the crippling of my son.
I'm looking at a report from NBC. At one event at Brown, 20 students were arrested by university police and charged with trespassing after they refused to leave a sit-in outside Brown President Christina Paxson's office. A friend of Hisham's, Daniel Newgarden, said that Hisham had attended a Shabbat dinner with some of the Jewish students who'd been arrested during the sit-in, and that they got together each Friday afterward. And they talked about the alliance between Jews and Palestinians, who they saw increasingly anxious after October 7th, Elizabeth.
Yes, Hisham did notify Brown that he felt unsafe on campus. I hadn't realized that. Hisham often wouldn't tell me things. He was so busy with his life, doing 5 courses and 20 hours of work. But he did feel anxious. He was active. And I have to tell you that when we heard about that sit-in by the Jewish students, we were moved. There has been such an incredible outpouring of support by Jewish activists in America. The concept of the Grand Central Station sit-in was something that reverberated around Palestine and really lifted our hearts. And then when Hisham sent me a picture of him at Shabbat dinner with these young people, I just felt like he was in the right community. I mean, when this type of thing happens, when Palestinians are so traumatized and so abused by the international community and the ignoring of their rights, my children learned over this last 7 weeks what it is to be on the wrong side of justice. And I think definitely my daughter and definitely Hisham, it opened their eyes up to what it is to be a part of an oppressed community and the opportunity for solidarity across that. Jewish people have been targeted for centuries by anti-Semitism. My other minorities in America, the Native Americans, have been in solidarity with the Palestinians, Black Americans. So many different minorities have reached out and been in stood in solidarity with the Palestinians. And I think that that's the life that I want my children to experience, to live in a community where they know and fight for the against the injustice that others suffer, and that they know that the others are standing with them in the injustice, against the injustice that the Palestinians suffer. So that Shabbat dinner gave me great joy when I heard about it.
People can go to Democracy Now! And see we were there at the Grand Central protest. Hundreds of Jews arrested as they shut down Grand Central Station on a Sabbath night, on a Friday night. If you can say what the doctors are saying right now, Elizabeth, Hisham has a bullet lodged in his spine. He also, his thumb, what else is...
So Hisham, from what I understand, he must have had his hand up when he was shot. And so the bullet went through his thumb into his clavicle. And then I think it may have ricocheted against his scapula. It broke, I think it touched a rib, and then it went into the T2 of his spine. So from what I understand, that trajectory and that passage meant that the bone slowed down the bullet, which is very lucky, because I think the bullet would have severed his spine. So currently the bullet has lodged there, and there's a concussive impact, which has meant that that Hisham has lost the sensation of pain and temperature, but he can feel pressure from his mid-torso downwards. So Hisham has to go through a long process of physical therapy to be able to regain the control of his muscles down there. In the short term, I believe that he will be able to learn how to live with that. He'll be given he'll be taught how to live with his disability. And our long-term plan is to support him to be able to regain motion, functional motion in all of his body. But my son has an incredible mind and an incredible soul. And he is already, the doctors say that it's hard sometimes to get people to engage with their new situation. And Hisham has been asking questions and inquiring and just taking control of it all with his with his curiosity and taking the information so he can process it. So he's tired, and it's a long, it's the next step is the next phase is going to be a very long process, but he's very determined and he's a brilliant and curious. And I know that he'll be a success no matter what he does.
He was shot in Vermont. There's a 3-member Vermont congressional delegation. You've got Becca Ballant, the first Jewish American Congress member to call for a ceasefire. Peter Welch just joined her, the Vermont senator. And Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, while he has not called for a ceasefire, he has called for aid to Israel to be conditioned on what's happening in the West Bank, on what's happening in Gaza. Your final thoughts on what you're calling for now, Elizabeth, as your son lies in the ICU?
Thank you. I think one of the things that I really want to emphasize is that it would be irresponsible for there to be any discussion of the mental health status of the perpetrator. There are millions of people suffering with mental health issues, and it is disrespectful to them to imply that mental health is something that leads to gun violence. There are millions of people in America with mental health to not pick up a gun and shoot, and it is irresponsible to victimize the shooter in this case. So any discussion of what his mental state was or his emotional state was is irresponsible. It's also a double standard. It is often applied to white perpetrators of shooting crimes, but not to those who are non-white or of different backgrounds, and particularly of minority backgrounds. And so I consider that to be unacceptable. And recent statements by the media that have highlighted that they broke me last night. And I find that incredibly offensive that people would victimize the shooter. I would also say that it is time to call for a ceasefire. The fact that the bomb started falling on Gaza again today crushed me. I celebrated Becca Ballant's stance, and I applaud and I'm so grateful for Peter Welch's statement of an unconditional ceasefire. The Palestinian people in Gaza have been brutalized by not just the bombardment, by the fact that they didn't have food, water, or fuel for weeks. They just sat there and died. I was in deep depression and mourning for 7 weeks, even before this happened to my son. And my son would be, I think, redeemed in his suffering if he knew that in any way, in any small way, attention brought to the Palestinian people through his plight helped to make the decision makers in the American government recognize that Palestinians are humans and Palestinians deserve to live. And if one more Palestinian child dies or is injured in the way that my son was injured, it is a travesty that this world should not have to live with. My son is receiving attention and the best medical care in America. If he was in Gaza or if he was in the West Bank, he would have been dead in prison or just thrown somewhere in a medical facility without the support he would need to be able to recover from this. So I am incredibly privileged, and as is my son, but he has been hurt here amongst this community who have supported us and provided us with the medical care where he is seen as a valid human being. And I think in my son's name, I call for all the decision makers and policymakers in the American government to recognize the Palestinian children in Gaza and the West Bank and in Jerusalem are also human and deserve the dignity and the support that my son is being provided with.
Elizabeth Price, we thank you so much for being with us. Mother of Hashem, please give him all of our regards. One of the 3 Palestinian students shot by a white man while visiting their family in Burlington, Vermont this past weekend. Elizabeth Price joining us from Burlington after traveling from Ramallah and the occupied West Bank. So did his father, to be at Hashem's side. Coming up, human rights attorney, war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody on the death of Henry Kissinger. Back in 20 seconds.
You got a way of walking.
You got a way of talking.
And it's something about you.
I wanna be haunted by the ghost.
Wanna be haunted by the ghost.
goes.
Haunted by Shane McGowan and the Popes, featuring Sinead O'Connor, Irish iconoclast frontman for the Pogues. The ever-complicated Shane McGowan passed away at the age of 65 Thursday. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking more at the death of Henry Kissinger, remembered by some as a leading diplomat, but by many others as a war criminal for his actions in Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Pakistan, Chile, Argentina, East Timor, and other countries. By some accounts, Kissinger was responsible for the deaths of at least 3 million people. Kissinger served as U.S. Secretary of State and National Security Advisor under Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. We're joined now by Reid Brody, human rights attorney, war crimes prosecutor, author of To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissein Habre. In June, Reid wrote an article for Just Security titled, Is Henry Kissinger a War Criminal? Well, why don't you answer that question, Reid, and talk about what should happen at this point. Now, at the age of 100, Henry Kissinger is dead.
Thank you, Amy. Well, as you've said, I mean, few people have had a hand in so much death and destruction in different parts of the world than Henry Kissinger. But what I tried to do in this article was look at specific instances of Henry Kissinger's action and whether he could be accused of war crimes. In fact, after the arrest of General Pinochet, Michael Ratner and I were teaching a class at Columbia Law School on the Pinochet precedent. We asked students to look at different incidents. And three in particular suggest that Henry Kissinger could have been accused of war crimes. One is Cambodia, the other is Pakistan, and the other, which you've talked about a lot on your show, is East Timor. I know we have little time. In Cambodia, we know that Henry Kissinger chose bombing targets, that he ordered that anything that moves be bombed. And that, in essence, is ordering a war crime, ordering that even civilian targets be attacked. In the case of East Pakistan, 1971, Pakistan was two separate countries. There was an election. An independence leader won in East Pakistan. But West Pakistan, Ayub Khan, would have nothing to do with it. And they started attacking civilians in East Pakistan, raping tens of thousands of women, hundreds of thousands killed. The American consul in East Pakistan wrote a memo to Henry Kissinger saying, we are participating in a genocide. We have to stop. The U.S. ambassador to India, Keating, the former senator of New York, told Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, we are participating in a genocide. Kissinger had the author of the memo fired. He called Keating a traitor. And not only did they not restrain Pakistan, who was receiving 80% of its military assistance from the United States, they actually organized the transfer of American weapons from Iran, from Jordan, to Pakistan as the bloodshed continued. So that makes Henry Kissinger liable for aiding and abetting the slaughter that was carried out there. A very similar situation that you know well, Amy, East Timor. Not only did Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford give the green light to the invasion of East Timor, but as the casualties mounted, as hundreds of thousands of Timorese were dying, the United States, which had a donor-client, as Henry Kissinger called it, relationship with East Timor, that was supplying 90% of Indonesia, 90% of Indonesia's military, gave additional assistance. And so these situations, Timor, East Pakistan, it's as if you're in an ammunition store and the guy is out there on a shooting spree and he comes back to get more ammunition and you give it to him. These things make Henry Kissinger, I believe, liable for war crimes.
Reid, we're going to continue this conversation after, and we're going to post it at democracynow.org. Reid Brody, human rights attorney, war crimes prosecutor, will link to your article, Is Henry Kissinger a War Criminal? That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
I teach my children about systemic racism and about historic and persistent colonialism and the responsibility that comes with their privilege. I will use my voice to speak up, and I will make more space at the table.
I will continue to educate myself and others in my community about the racism and inequities faced by BIPOC.
We will not be silent and idle.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.